Air Force is the youngest of the three military services, or four, if you include the Marines as a separate operation. They, of course, insist that they are separate. But normally, we talk about the three branches of the military service. Our Passover is the 18th of September, 1947. So we were 20 years old a few months ago. Not that there weren't people flying before, but we were part of the Army Signal Corps for a while, and we were the aviation section, the Army Air Forces, until 18 September 47, when the Air Force became an autonomous operation. The purpose of the Air Force is to defend the United States and other freedom-loving nations in the elements of air and space. The Navy is assigned to water, although it has airplanes also. The Army is assigned to the ground, although it also has airplanes. In fact, it has more airplanes than the Air Force, because we are gradually becoming an aerospace service with more responsibility for missiles and space operations than air. In fact, most commands are being renamed aerospace rather than air. Throughout our 20 years, the Air Force has been a deterrent to nuclear war. We have participated decisively in national and international efforts to prevent smaller wars, to restore order where peace had been violated, and to establish conditions conducive to economic and social progress. We're very busy, of course, in Southeast Asia, particularly in Thailand, somewhat in Cambodia, and quite a bit in Vietnam. The work there is largely tactical, with the F-111, the 111, and the new F-4 working for us. And of course, there is strategic bombing with the B-52s from Guam and from Thailand. Incidentally, we do not fly B-52s over North Vietnam. I didn't realize that until the other day someone called my attention to it, because it would really destroy our image if we ever lost a B-52 over North Vietnam. So we're confining our efforts with B-52s to South Vietnam. One of our major projects is to develop the manned orbital laboratory for people to go out into space and to find out what space can be used for. And of course, we are particularly interested in this project because it is obvious that the Soviet Union has already undertaken certain efforts in this direction. The Air Force has its reserve, the Air National Guard, as a kind of strategic backup. We were called up in the Berlin crisis of 61, that is 50,000 reservists, and of course this time 15,000 have been called back. Last year, the Air National Guard and the reserves did about 8% of the total delivery of tonnage to South Vietnam, so that the reserves in the Air Force are quite intimately related to the whole program of the Air Force itself. Now a little bit about the structure of the Air Force. What I say here will of course have its equivalent in the other two services, but our basic unit in the Air Force is what we call the flight. The flight is a group of four men organized for whatever purpose they may be organized. You take a number of flights and you get squadrons. Two or three flights, four flights, make a squadron. That's your basic administrative unit in the Air Force. A number of squadrons put together make a group. And a number of groups make wings. The wings are our basic operational unit. And when you put a number of wings together, you get an Air Force, 15, 8, 20, whatever the case may be. And when you put a number of Air Forces together, you get a command. A major command, like Military Airlift Command, Continental Air Command, tactical training command, tactical air command, I should say, and air training command. These are some of the major ones, and of course, strategic air command. Then at the top of the major command, as one headquarters, we have headquarters USAF. That's the military structure, and it would function very well without chaplains as a military operation. But it is also organized in such a way, in its tables of organization and equipment, as to allow for chaplains to operate at various levels of command. Usually they are at wing level, working at installation on bases. Above them are Air Force chaplains, called staff chaplains, and then above the staff chaplains are the major command chaplains, plus the chief of chaplains up at headquarters USAF. On top of the chief of chaplains in the Air Force is what we call the Armed Forces Chaplain Board. This is on the level of the Secretary of Defense, the DOD. That interest is represented not by one man, but by a board, where the chairman changes every year. The Army has it for 1 year, the Navy the next, the Air Force the next, and so on round. This board represents the three services in their joint reflection on chaplain problems, and they report to the Secretary of Defense on issues that are current. For instance, on what kind of chapels to build, how much money to spend, what's the optimum size of a military chapel, what kind of religious education facilities are needed, what are the best. These questions, of course, rise in all three services. So they are fed from the individual services, by way of their chief, to the Armed Forces Chaplain Board, where these major decisions are made. The unified curriculum, for example, for the Sunday schools in the three services are handled at that level, to be sure that all three are working with the same curriculum. Let me start then, with respect to the Air Force now, to point out that the Air Force itself, with this military structure, assumes responsibility for a religious program in the service. Now, it need not be this, you see. In fact, the American Civil Liberties Union would like to eliminate this particular aspect of responsibility. The Air Force meets this responsibility in three ways. It makes the commander responsible also for items of religion, morale, morals, and moral leadership. Secondly, it provides the military, or it provides slots in its organization for a qualified clergyman to serve as chaplain. Now, that need not be the case either, but it is. This is part of our national tradition and heritage. And thirdly, the Air Force, like the other two services, provides the facilities and the necessary equipment to carry out the duties and functions of the Air Force chaplaincy, and that's no mean undertaking. The chaplains have to defend their request for funds before Congress when they want to build a new chapel or religious education facility. And this is a regular procedure. 2 years ahead of time, you project your needs locally. Then a year before a particular fiscal year, you draw up a budget request. And then within that year, this is gathered together by the command chaplains and through the chief of chaplains of the Air Force, is presented to the DOD, the Department of Defense, for recommendation to Congress. Now, this is a major operation involving millions and millions of dollars. Just now in the Air Force, we are at the point of trying to apply new principles of management, setting up the local chaplain on the base as a responsibility and cost center So that the senior chaplain on a base, and I'm now talking about the Air Force specifically, which usually is ahead in this sort of thing, the senior chaplain on the base has to determine ahead of time how much money he needs to pay the salaries of the people that are working with him, how much money he needs for equipment, how much money he needs, for example, to engage buses on Sunday morning to bring the children into Sunday school and to church services, how much money he needs for communion wine, for wafers, for Sunday bulletin. And this is programmed, then he gets a certain number in the IBM operation, and part of his effectiveness is determined at the end of the year in seeing how close he got to his own estimates and how efficiently he spent the money that was available to him. This means that no one else can take that money which has been allocated to him in the fiscal operation of the military establishment. And the program locally will fail or will succeed partly according to the man's own plans and estimates and distribution. Communion kits, for example, are not cheap, and every Air Force chaplain gets one of these. There are other types of equipment, like missiles, scriptures, prayer books, candles, crucifixes, you name it, and this is part of the equipment which is provided by the Air Force. The Sunday offerings, therefore, are not taken to pay the chaplain's salary. They are used to purchase incidentals that may not be available otherwise. Some of them are taken up to help some case of poverty or some humanitarian need. So the Air Force meets its responsibilities in those three ways, and I want to talk about the second one, commissioning qualified clergymen to serve as chaplain. The chaplain occupies, first of all, a professional status in the Air Force. That is, he belongs to a certain denomination. He is expected to represent his denomination faithfully. In fact, his ecclesiastical endorsement can be withdrawn if he is not. The function of the Civilian Armed Forces Boards or Commissions is to select the individuals who will represent the church in the Air Force, Army, and Navy. Dr. Bertrand will say a great deal more about that. He was on our commission for at least one term and knows a great deal about the internal workings of that operation. This means, for example, that if you belong to the Missouri Synod, you're expected to reflect the position of the Missouri Synod. Consequently, for example, you do not hold joint services with people of other denominations. This is a little awkward at times, but it is in keeping with our traditions and the wishes of our denomination. You do not hold an open communion service, a general Protestant communion service, as a Methodist can, for instance, or a Southern Baptist often cannot, as you can. While you can hold a general Protestant service, and I'll refer to that in a minute, you couldn't hold an open communion service because that is contrary to the principles of our particular denomination. So we do occupy this professional status, as we call it. We have a responsibility toward our church denomination, and we show this by submitting the monthly report that the Armed Forces Commission requests us to make out. In addition, of course, you have an official status in the Air Force. You're part of the structure. And this is one of the great advantages of the military chaplaincy. You are part of the structure. The tables of organization take your presence into account. You have access to the commanding officer at any time. As a matter of fact, normally the chaplain is on the staff of the commanding officer as a special advisor, like a medical man. If therefore something goes wrong, on the base in terms of morals or morality or morale, religion, the chaplain can go directly to his commanding officer to pick up this problem. He may not want to do it that way, but he can. He may want to talk to the administrative director instead, but he has the privilege to go directly to the commanding officer, which incidentally he could never do if he were not in uniform and had a certain rank. There's some talk nowadays, you know, about taking the chaplaincy out of uniform and providing a civilian ministry. We've gone through that period. It just doesn't work. How do you get to a commanding officer unless you have rank and a uniform? How could you get to General Estes over here, the commanding general of military airlift command, if you were not a full colonel? And this is part of the ritual. You wouldn't get there as a civilian. He wouldn't have time for you, just as he never sees the Red Cross representative. He leaves that to somebody else. Therefore, operating on these various levels of command is of very great importance, because that's where the wheels are turning. If, for instance, there's some hot and bothered CO out somewhere trying to tell his chaplain what to say and how to preach, which is contrary to regulation, that chaplain can take up his case with the chaplain at the next level, where it will be taken up with the proper people, and remedied in short order. This could not possibly be done without being part of the structure. Another advantage, of course, in the structure, and perhaps this is the chief one, is that you can serve people where they really are. The Wisconsin Synod has one civilian in all of Vietnam who has to scrounge whatever rides he can get and can never get to the places where religious services are really needed, namely at the front, wherever the front is, and it's everywhere. You can't be there because there's hardly enough room for the military people to operate. And they're not about to let a lot of other individuals into the area. But the chaplains are there. They eat with the men, they sleep with the men, they work with them, they're around, and can provide services. This is part of the advantage of having an official status. When you apply here, you get a provisional commission, a second lieutenant in the Air Force, second lieutenant in the Army, provisional ensign in the Navy. Then, once you are ordained, you can apply for your regular commission. And that regular commission, the first lieutenancy or captaincy, whatever you get at that point, is the equal of every other captain, lieutenant in the structure. And so it goes. And you have that commission partly to have access to the right sources and to the right centers of power and direction. In addition to having an official status with all that this involves in terms of uniform, wearing it, and following the regulations, you also have a social status in the military establishment. Now, in wartime, this is not so important as it is in peacetime. The services have certain customs and courtesies. For example, when you report on a post or a base, normally you are expected within 24 hours to call on the commanding officer at his home for about 15 minutes, and you leave your calling card in the silver disc that sits on the table at the front door. And you'll see that silver disc as soon as you enter. So you leave this. This is part of the custom. And then he will return that call within the next 24 hours, he and his wife, normally, his lady, in peacetime. Now, some of these are cut out when things are a little rougher. The CO has his annual Christmas party and his New Year party, or reception. This year, incidentally, there was a change. We had it in the morning from 10:30 to 12 so that the people could watch the road roll in. But it was held from 10:30 to 12. And the chaplain, as an officer, is expected to be there. If he were an enlisted man, he wouldn't have that responsibility. That would not be part of his customs and courtesy. And we have such other niceties which are well worth following and imitating. Like always reporting at a place 5 minutes ahead of time. So you don't waste anybody's time that way. Everybody is present for a staff meeting on time because they've all been there 5 minutes ahead of time. This is a very, very fine courtesy, I would say, which we could well afford to adopt, incidentally, in our particular profession, to be at a place 5 minutes ahead of time in order to be sure that you're there on time. So much for the social status. Now, the activity of the Air Force chaplain. Some of this was covered by Dr. Peacorn last week when he talked about the Army. But let me try to fill in a little bit more as these items apply to the chaplaincy in the Air Force. The first responsibility that a chaplain has is to conduct worship services. And under U.S. regulations, he has the job of providing religious services for all the personnel on the base to which he is assigned. This does not mean that he himself holds these services, necessarily. But he has to see to it that for every Sabbath and Sunday, there are services to cover the religious needs of that base. And here, by the way, we run into a very major difference in the organization of the Air Force chaplaincy from that of the Army. This can be debated both ways and has been debated many times. In the Army, you are assigned as a chaplain to a unit, regardless of where on what post that unit may be stationed. You have your loyalty to that unit. Well, in the Air Force, the chaplains on a particular base usually occupy offices in the chapel or in some chapel facility together. They operate on a single program under the wing chaplain or group chaplain, whatever his designation is, and are not specifically assigned, except maybe informally, to given units. Now, admittedly, this distracts or detracts somewhat from the relationship of a chaplain to troops, but it has a lot of other advantages, namely that the program on a base is a single program into which all of the chaplains contribute from their particular point of view and with their particular efforts. For example, one chaplain will have the responsibility for religious education. And when you get that assignment, please grab it and do a good job with it, because this is one job that we as Lutherans can do real well, religious education, because it involves teaching the Sunday school teachers. And this is, to me, a great challenge. I always kept this job for myself, even when I was a wing chaplain, because that opportunity I wanted, to teach the teachers. And many civilians aren't aware of the fact that we have tremendous Sunday schools. In Wiesbaden, we have 1,800 kids in Sunday school. You can imagine what kind of teachers that took, 210. So you've got 210 people to teach as you decide to do it, once a week, once every 2 weeks. This is more than the size of certain congregations to which you may be called. Another chaplain will be the hospital chaplain, let's say, and when you get that job, do it well. There's a great contribution to make in that area. So on an air base, the religious program is a unified thing, which comes under the direction and the supervision of the wing chaplain, the installation chaplain. The Army is not organized that way, nor is the Navy, because of certain difficulties. It would be very hard to get the program of some cruiser out somewhere unified with something else. That's a unit all by itself. And naturally, greater loyalties develop, personal loyalties, perhaps, than in the Air Force. So that's the first job, to provide worship services. Now, how do you fit in as a Lutheran chaplain? Missouri Synod. Incidentally, when you come into the service as a Missouri Synod chaplain, you will be treated with great respect, because the Missouri Synod has a tremendous record in the military chaplaincy. And this is very different from what it was in 19, 41 when I came in. Nobody knew about the Missouri Synod. And when I reported to Chanute Field out here in Illinois the first time in May 41, and the post chaplain said, well, that's good that you came. We need somebody to preach at the joint service next Sunday, in which a Jewish man will lead the service. I said, well, I'm sorry, sir, but my denomination just wouldn't let me do this. And I think you would know his reaction. He said, well, what in thunderation are you in the service for? Well, he found out later on. Years later, he came once when he was retired, and he apologized for being so crude that first day, because in the meantime, he had learned that one can work in the service even with our peculiar attitude toward joint services. One advantage you have, the Episcopal chaplain also has this advantage, is that you're expected to do a denominational service, a Lutheran service. And you can do it every Sunday if you want it. And I always have, did, every Sunday. Not just once a month, as some chaplains do, but every Sunday. Evening or early Sunday morning, somewhere outside the prime hours. The prime hours are from 9 to 12. And nothing is supposed to interfere during that period with the general Protestant services and the Roman Catholic masses. But the rest of the Sunday is available to you. You can have it at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 6 o'clock in the evening, whatever you decide. And even if you don't get to do a general Protestant service for some reason or other for a number of months, you've always got this. And you meet some of the most wonderful Lutherans from all over the world in the pursuit of this specific ministry. Better denominational service always ranks second to the primary responsibility of what we call a general Protestant service. Now, in a way, this is a misnomer. There is no such thing as a general Protestant service. The general Protestant service is what you make it. And as soon as you introduce a confession and words of absolution, people will recognize at once that you're a Lutheran chaplain. But you set up the order of service. Two of them are recommended in the front part of the Armed Forces Hymnal, and it's sometimes useful to follow that pattern. They're pretty good. Or you develop your own. And your effectiveness is determined entirely by what you do with this general Protestant service. Now, in a general Protestant service, obviously, you don't take up denominational differences. You don't set aside a general Protestant service to discuss baptism. In its differences. You might, of course, discuss the doctrine in general. But you wouldn't want to get up, for instance, and in a general Protestant service and take off against the Methodist view on communion. It's a matter of courtesy and horse sense, stable thinking. Horse sense. As someone said. This is a great opportunity. This is where you get the people who then ask you, well, look, chaplain, can I have some instruction? I want to join the church that you belong to. And if you've got something to say, as most Lutherans do, you'll have many people asking you. In fact, the first few years I was at Chanute Field, I went through the catechism 51 times. 1 year. 51 times. Well, anybody could wake me up at 2 o'clock in the morning and ask me what question 252, I could tell them the question and the answer. Because chances are I had been through it the night before. And as Dr. Pecan mentioned, the chaplains in the military were more adult converts for the church than any other group of people working for the church, including foreign missionaries. As a matter of fact, the greatest mission field in the world is the military service. For even though many people claim a church connection of some kind, they don't really have any. 60% of the people, chances are, have never been in church more than once, somewhere. Their grandmother may have been a Methodist, but not they themselves. And of course, this provides tremendous opportunity. You don't even have to learn a new language, you see, to cross it. We speak English, roughly. So. So you provide worship services, and you do the pastoral functions. You baptize, you marry, you distribute the Lord's Supper, you bury, whatever else it takes in the ministry. You call on the people. Usually this is organized once a year by the wing chaplain. You call on everybody on the base in the interest of a religious census. Pick up your Sunday school applicants that way, and the members for the choir, and that kind of thing. Now, one of the great advantages you work with in the Air Force is that every time a man moves to a new base, he has to report during his processing in to the chaplain, who fills out a card on him, to see what his religious background is, whether he's interested in choir, Boy Scout, whatever it may be. And you've got all that information available all the time in your office. And use it to maximum degree. You are responsible for religious education. I've already mentioned that the military establishment has enormous Sunday schools, 800, 900 kids, 1,500 around Tokyo, 1,800 Wiesbaden. On Okinawa, I suppose it runs over 2,000, which means you're working with teachers, the organization of a curriculum, materials, and you can sneak in teachers, materials, real fast. In fact, most Sunday school teachers appreciate the stuff that Concordia Publishing House puts out, sometimes more than we ourselves do. You have responsibility for confirmation instruction, and here you're on your own. Saturday morning is there to take the kids who are 12, 11, 12, 13 years old and teach them. Teach them the way you would in a civilian place. Catechism, the glorious catechism that we now have. And you have all kinds of opportunities for adult membership classes. In fact, the only limitation is your own energy and the time. Then you've got the job of moral education. We refer to it in the Air Force as moral leadership. We abolished the program a couple of years ago, but it's gradually being rebuilt, starting at the level of basic training. We just put out four 25-minute films, which are excellent, on basic moral problems. And that's the beginning of expanding this program once more. This is the opportunity to present to men the basic moral elements that go into the creation of a free life. Dr. Tikhon will talk more about personal counseling. He alluded to it last time. Most of your time, waking time, will be spent in personal counseling. In fact, this is endless, really. You simply have to go away, leave this job once in a while as a matter of survival, because you will be dealing with such complicated marital problems, vocational problems. You will come home utterly exhausted from one session after another. One great advantage you have in the chaplaincy is that you've got all kinds of other people to help you. The Red Cross people, the medical people are right there on the base. You've got the social workers available. The whole team is there, and you operate as a team anyway in this kind of procedure. You will be interested in humanitarian services, in teaching whatever congregation you have to take part in the 1 hour of sharing, or world relief, or the bishop's hour, or bishop fund, as it is called in the case of Roman Catholics, to contribute to human needs. There will be all kinds of human needs on the base itself, in terms of sick mothers, the two large families, and here you organize help organize the officers' wives or your non-com officers' wives in such a way that there's a committee somewhere that you can contact in cases of need that you know about. You will do a lot of activity with deals in public relations, from the Sunday bulletin that you print to the speeches that you make off base. I'm speaking geographically now, off base. It is good also in the civilian parish to be sure that your Sunday bulletin is neat. There's nothing that can destroy the image of the church and does destroy it so quickly as this sloppy kind of typing, which is so characteristic of Sunday bulletins. You know, typeovers and mistakes. There's no reason why it shouldn't be right the first time. We have a motto in the Air Force, zero defects, which means do it right the first time. Why do you have to go to it the second time? So why not do the Sunday bulletin the right way the first time? See that all the words are spelled correctly and that you practice notes. And here, let me say, you have available, this is one advantage you have over this brilliant place, in a way, an excellent staff. We have a whole career field of chaplain specialists. They are trained down at Amarillo in their supervising capacity, how to organize an office, how to keep files, how to type. And this is a tremendous relief. You don't have to sit there and putter around with your own typewriter. Turn it over to somebody. That's what he or she is there for. Chances are you'll have a civilian secretary in the office. So that none of this tiddling little stuff you need to do, because your time is more valuable. You go out to where the problems are, counseling, whatever else needs to be done. And as Dr. Pecorn mentioned last time, the chaplain does have certain responsibilities for cultural leadership, especially those that relate to church life, like putting on the Messiah somewhere during Advent, or sacred concerts. Drama, this is a wide open field with which many people work. Now, there are 7 points, in other words, I think that I mentioned 3, 4, 5, 8. Worship services, pastoral functions, religious education, moral education, personal counseling, humanitarian services, public relations, and cultural leadership. And if you look at those 8 points, of which the first three and then the fifth are the most important, worship services, pastoral functions, religious education, and personal counseling. If you look at these, you will discover that all of your time will be taken up and you don't have much time for mystery. Believe me. Well, this is the opportunity. There is no greater opportunity in the world, really, than the chaplaincy in the Air Force, Army, or Navy. Substantially, they don't differ. Now, time for some questions. About 5 minutes or so. Yes. No, you're not permitted to accept them. No. You have locally on the base a fund to work with called the Central Base Fund, to which the profits from the DX go. And these are enormous profits, I might say. And a good chaplain is on that council, and he will get funds from there to buy the Sunday flowers, you know, and certain other things that are not available from appropriated funds. No, you may not take other funds. No. Just as you may not receive an honorarium when you go out as a chaplain to some civilian church and take a service. You may not be paid. Well, the pay of a chaplain is normally real good, so you don't worry about that. Ross? Well, you can use your rank in his behalf, you see. Suppose there is a problem that the CO needs to know about in case of Joe Bloke over there. He doesn't have a rank. He'll never get there. But you can, for him, that you accept it. And I have discovered that this doesn't bother the GIs. As soon as they recognize the cross, they kind of forget about this up here on the shoulder or on the sleeve. Well, until the chaplain commends himself and they discover he's a pretty good fellow that you can trust. Yes, of course, rank does have that effect. For instance, if you walk into a room of troops, they're supposed to rise, somebody yells attention, and they're supposed to rise. This is part of the custom and courtesy. But then you say at ease, and the troops are wrong. But what rank can do, you see, we fellows try to get an appointment with a flight surgeon over at Sky Air Force Base and got pushed off to what, February 21, was it? Well, so I put on my uniform yesterday and went over to see the flight surgeon. And somehow they found time on February 6th. I couldn't do that as a civilian. And it really didn't take any effort. Didn't even have to argue. I just said I have 3 minutes until your seminary that needs to be examined before, what was it, February 14th? They called in here and they were told they couldn't get here until February 21. Do you have room before? Yeah, February 6th. You can't do that any other way. In the kind of structure this calls for this. Yes, sir. In fact, in the Air Force, it's a little easier because the crews on an airplane consist of both officers and non-officers, non-coms and airmen. And when they work together, they forget completely about the fact that this man may be a major and he's a captain and here's a sergeant and here's an airman second class because they're all working together. Now, this one advantage we have in the Air Force, it's much less rigid than the Army and the Navy. And I don't say it's critical, it's just that just happens to be the situation. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned that
And we have such a long tradition in the service now that the fellows quickly bring into this, they know the story. Somebody else had a question, observation? Now, I have had only one slip of paper from someone who listened to a tape. These speeches are available in the library on tape for anybody who can't be here. But I would like to have a slip of paper still indicated. How many people, incidentally, have applied for the Army this year? I have only two notices of two. And I thought I had sent a notice to everyone asking that you make up your mind by a certain date. So maybe it would get going. By the way, Tom, I have your note. There is no housing on the post at Fort Hamilton. But the commandant suggests that in summertime, it is possible to sublet. Well, he doesn't care what you do over the weekend.
Oh.
Over the weekend. Oh. No, we live in a barracks, in a VOQ rather, during the week. But over the weekend, that doesn't matter. But there is no housing on base. This is reserved for the chaplains who are there for the 9 month tour. They live right here. No. Do it on your own. There is no special office for that. No. Oh, yes, well, yeah. Usually on a base there are two chaplains, and Protestant chaplains, one Roman Catholic. This is a kind of normal configuration. So you can't have a general Protestant service. You turn that Sunday over to somebody else. If you want that kind of communion service. Otherwise, you can have it on Sunday evenings and announce that it is a Lutheran communion service and explain what it is you're doing. And then, of course, anyone who wants to come, you have no right to deny at that point. And this would be true especially if you are the only chaplain. Now, I was the only chaplain with a unit for 2.5 years. And of course, this becomes a very crucial problem. So I was out at Sunday night and explained what we were doing. And only one man ever took exception to it, and that was an ex-Southern Baptist preacher. Any other questions on this? Well, thank you very much for your attention. Did you all find this great sheet of paper that's floating around? Ted Riffle, you got the announcement about 7:30 Tuesday morning? All right.